This is the Ed Milet Show.
Welcome back to Max Out, everybody. This is going to be a great show today. Wanted to do it for a long time. The gentleman needs no introduction. 5 best-selling books, 12 years on television. He's my favorite shark of all the sharks, and a few of them are my friends, so I say that with some bias. He's also, in my opinion, one of the greatest motivational and business speakers on earth. He's one of my favorite people to listen to. Took like $40, turned it into billions of dollars in FUBU, and he's one of the great entrepreneurs of all time too. So Damon John, welcome to Max Out. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Ed. I mean, I think the feeling and the respect is mutual. Thank you for the kind words, and I appreciate being here.
Thank you, brother. If I met you young, I'm just curious, would I have known this was going to happen for you? I mean, was there something about you that had I met you as a young man that would have indicated all of this would happen for you?
You know, it depends on the time you met me during my life. You know, at the time when I was super naive and I thought it was just easy, you would have met me, I'd have been like, not a problem. And then that would have been probably around 16 or 17. I think that's when, you know, they like to induct people into the armed forces because that's the smartest and the dumbest time of your life. And at that time, I thought I would have been it. And then right around 21, 22, I realized that I took that 1 year off of school, off of college, to pursue other things. That 1 year became forever. I laughed at all the other kids who searched a higher education. And around 22, 23, I was broke as a waiter in Red Lobster. And all those kids that I laughed at was coming back from college. And I said, maybe I'm the idiot. So it all depends on the time that you met me in life and how naive I was. And if life had kicked me in the teeth properly the way it should have.
The thing I noticed when we met, the reason I ask you that is that, and we'll go to your little bit, you know, about your upbringing a little bit, but when I met you, one thing that struck me, and we've both met lots of people, is your personal presence. So I've heard you say before, I'm short, I'm black, and I'm dyslexic, you know, and that's, you've described yourself that way. When I met you, I met a man with a ton of personal presence, almost bordering on almost intimidating. But certainly a lot of confidence. That's why what I ask, have you always had that? Or is that something you developed as you became more successful? Or were you conscious, like, I need to develop this air of confidence about me? Because all these entrepreneurs are listening to this. And one of the things that I think a lot of them lack is just some personal presence and self-confidence. Did you always have it or did you work on it?
I think it was a learned trait, and being the short black or whatever. But let's just say in my neighborhood, I was short. A lot of kids, you know, at that time were tough or they were drug dealers or fighters. I never really knew how to fight really well. Could I hold my own? Yes. But there's always somebody with a bigger wallet, bigger winky and a bigger fist than you in the world. And I always realized that. I think that it was then when I was able to manipulate my surroundings by knowing that the bigger kids respected me because I was smart or because some of the other cool kids or the drug dealer friends of mine respected me because I had a moral standard. And I said, listen, if you got something in the car and I know we're good friends, just tell me to get out, man. Don't put me in that situation. And as I started to, gain respect in various different areas for various different people, I found that I gained the confidence to walk into a room and know that I'm all I got, right? And I'm not going to overplay or disrespect you. And I never played smarter than I was. So I love, when you and I, when we speak to colleges or VCs or whoever, it's a lot of people in the room often with the big brains, especially when I speak at big, huge schools. I make sure I go in the room and I say, listen, I'm only going to tell you my story. And this is my story. And this is what I have retained from my story. However, the people here, the professors, they can teach me a lot of things on a PhD level. And I don't even want to take away from them because I value what they do. And then all of a sudden you see the professor sitting up in the audience looking around because they know that I could have came in and said, well, I'm Mr. So forth and so on. And this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And so when I walk into a room, I appreciate the other person's positioning. I know where I stand, and I think that makes us, and I try to bring that other person up if they're not feeling like they're there. I think that's what gives me the confidence because I know I'm exuberant in confidence as well as I'm trying to bring the confidence out of the person in the world, the room, and I respect them. And I hopefully that is what you were witnessing.
Yeah, I did. People have asked me about it, I've described it. And I think there's this balance with successful entrepreneurs. I mean, obviously, they have to have a great idea. They have to be able to execute. They have a really unique balance that I see in you of really a presence and a self-confidence, yet humility to learn and to grow and to be open. You seem to have like that major combination. go back to the upbringing, just because I want people to understand you're one of the most well-known, obviously, because of Shark Tank entrepreneurs too. But like you've written 5 books and, but are you legitimately dyslexic? Like,
yeah.
How's that impacted you as an entrepreneur? I mean, how'd you write books doing that?
Well, you know, believe it or not, eight out of the 12 sharks are dyslexic. So Richard Branson, whoa, myself, Kevin O'Leary, Barbara, I think Rohan, and two others that don't come to mind at the moment. So it's fascinating. And I didn't really find out that I was dyslexic till years on in life. I didn't find out I was dyslexic until two-way pagers came out, because you got to remember, as a dyslexic kid, I'd write a love note or I'd write a letter to my mom. You know, my mother, Damon, hey, and she'll say, hey, you need to fix this. I write it to my teacher. She sends back the really nice, D minus. And I write a love letter to my girlfriend. She just leaves me. And I never knew why. She didn't understand what the hell I was saying. Right. but when communication started to come out to write to other people, emails and two-way pages, I would start sending stuff out. And I probably had just started getting a staff at the time, and people would start getting those emails going or two-way pages going, and you know, a couple of them would say, hey, D, you know this? Or if it was a really angry one to somebody, they'd write back, you dumb motherfucker, you know what you said to me? So either way, I started to understand that there was an issue there. And then I went and got tested and realized that I had dyslexia. But when I reflect on growing up as a child with dyslexia, I think the gift of dyslexia is the fact that if I had read a book and I didn't retain anything as much as I should, I'd read it 10 times to make sure I retained things. I would also go out and try to execute things that it said to do, because I wasn't certain if I retained it the right way. I also veered away from school from history and English, but I really loved math and science and started trying to build the areas I was good at, numbers, and various other things. So listen, it is what I was born with. 20% of the world is dyslexic. 7 presidents were dyslexic. Einstein was dyslexic, and 85% of professional chefs are, and over 40% of entrepreneurs are dyslexic. So I don't think it's a problem. I think it's just a different form of absorbing information.
Wow, I had no idea that was the data. The reason I go there is like, I think we're all really aware of our deficiencies. Like for me, it's one of the things you said, I walk into most rooms and I know I don't have the highest IQ in the room, you know? But I didn't allow that thing I was aware of that was one of my deficiencies to make me believe I couldn't be successful or win. I think a lot of people listen to this. They're like, well, yeah, y'all winning, but you don't know this thing about me. Like I've got this divorce, or I had this bankruptcy, or I'm dyslexic, or, you know, my dad's been locked up, or whatever the thing is. And they start using that thing as the thing in their mind that will cause them not to succeed. And then I'm reading about you because I wanted to do this justice, because I have such respect for who you are and also your message. When I heard you talk, I'm like, I love what he has to say. So you're building FUBU. You literally, because I want entrepreneurs to hear this, because in COVID, this is happening a lot. You had to shut it down a couple times.
Yeah.
I mean, I want everyone to understand this. Take us through that a little bit, because I think most people think it's over, game closed, doors shut, I'm out. Well, that didn't just happen once with you, right?
Correct. So I shut it down 3 times from 89 to 92. It did not happen once, but I was always able to recover from the shutdown because I was taking affordable steps, right? I was acting, I was learning, and I was repeating the act. So I would lose $500, $1,000. And honestly, I didn't know if I wanted to start over again. Again, it was another hustle, another passion that I had. Well, this one was more passion than all the ones. The other ones were due purely to make money, and I didn't love what I was doing. So I ended up quitting or closing up whatever shop it was and not wanting to go further. But when I would close this business and people would say, man, I wore this shirt, I've been looking for you at the mall or at the kiosk. Where were you? I can't. It started to call me back, and I found more reasons than the business that called me back. I felt like a place of belonging. I felt like I was adding value to other people. You know what? I got shirts. I got my 10 little shirts, but I'm going on video sets where rappers like LL Cool J, Salt-N-Pepa, Run DMC are performing. I would have paid to go on that set to watch the greatest artists, as far as I'm concerned, of all times, my time, perform. But yet when the security is kicking all the kids off, I'm like, yeah, I'm here to dress the artist, you know. So they would kick me off last. Plus, I was hollering at all the video vixens, and I was getting free food from the craft services. So it was a win-win for me. So even if I went to 40 video sets and only five put my stuff in, 35 of the video sets, I couldn't wait to be there. So it was a win all around. And that's what a lot of times when entrepreneurs see that they're challenged, they find ways to figure it out because there's so many more things than just the monetary. Usually the monetary reward is an afterthought of your actions and the lessons you've learned and the drive and your dedication. And that's what I found it to be.
Did you have to get a job in between? Like you shut it down, you went and got a regular old job?
Oh my God. So I worked at Red Lobster for 5 years, as I did FUBU, because, you know, at the end of the day, don't let Shark Tank fool anybody here when Kevin O'Leary says, well, I want my partner to work full time on the business. Okay, if you're doing $500,000, $1 million, or whatever the case is. But, you know, I worked at Red Lobster for 5 years and I slept three hours a night. I rented out my house that I had to strangers. So I had three bedrooms. I rented that out for $25 a piece, each bedroom. I slept in the sleeping bags next to the sewing machines as we were sewing clothes. In the morning from 6 to 11 a.m., I would answer at that time a voicemail machine and sew and deliver hats. I'd go to Red Lobster from 12 to 10 o'clock at night, work a double shift, come home and then sew more hats and answer more things from 12 to 3 and then get back up at 6 in the morning. I repeat it all over, but I was hopefully taking care of the mortgage by renting out the house at $25 a room. So I was getting $75 a week there. I had insurance at Red Lobster. I was taking all the fried shrimp home, all the food home, and I was making $30,000 a year, which is not a lot, but you equate that to 5 years, that's $150,000. I would have had to do $2 million in business at FUBU to do that. And I was able to last until I was able to now, you know, increase my time from, you know, 20% on FUBU to 80% on FUBU and 20% of Red Lobster, and then hopefully take it to where I wanted to go.
This is the real entrepreneur story. This is what I wanted. Thank God you just said that. Like, I'm so glad because, like, I just, so everybody knows, like, same with me. I had a house. I was doing well. I did well enough. So, like, I quit my job. I was full-time, my first big business. I bought a house. Then I went broke. Then I was stocking shelves. And I did the same thing. I rented rooms out in my house so I didn't lose the damn house as I built my business. I just hope all entrepreneurs get a little hope when they hear this. And also they hear the hard part in there, which is like, hey, I slept 3 hours. Yeah. I was psycho. So, and by the way, when people seem really smart, like Damon does, or I have something to say, a lot of it is experience. Experience is one of the best teachers, man. And that's why he knows so much about being an entrepreneur, because he's done so much of it. Now, I want to ask you this. On Shark Tank, how many events that you've invested in, percentage-wise, roughly, winners, losers, what you would consider a winner, loser, what would you say of where you put your efforts and monies, what percentage of the ones you've gone in on have been winners and losers?
So I say 30% of winners. I would say 30% of winners, 30% of losers, and 30% are still trying to figure their way out. Yep. And we happen to have, of course, we happen to have a little bit more of an upside on Shark Tank, because you look at traditional venture, it's probably 1.5 to 2%, 20%, excuse me, yep, or 1 out of 10 are winners. We happen to have a $5 million commercial on that product, exactly, and or that company when it happened. So that's why I got a little bit more of an upswing. However, my downside is a little bit more also, because Shark Tank, sometimes I will emotionally invest in people that may not have the best thing in the world, but I know that the entire world are watching them. And if I invest in them, I can potentially bring them to somebody else that may be more specialized in their area and give them more help that they need. Mm-hmm. And a perfect example of that, and I don't want anybody to say, well, that's a charity. A perfect example of that is the three kids that came on with a cut board product that their father had passed away and their mother had passed away, but their father passed away to 9/11 related causes. And normally that cut board probably would not have went where it has gone, but we licensed it to Williams Sonoma. The entire world got behind it, and it is one of the best selling products in Williams Sonoma. So you got that healthy balance of people that really need that stage, that really need help, but simultaneously they're inspiring a lot of people around the country and around the world. So anyway, to answer the question, I got a little bit of a stacked deck when it comes to the successes, but I got a little bit more of the challenges when it comes to the challenges.
Yeah, I want to figure out a little bit from you what the winners and losers have. One of my favorite ones you did is Bomba Socks. And yeah, I want people to hear about this, because I had Blake Mikoski on, who did Tom's Shoes, kind of a similar concept, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like maybe these guys taught you something too. I'm learning, you know, I'm turning 50 this year. I'm learning more about what I think the consciousness of the world is now in terms of the businesses people want to support. Maybe it's a little bit different than when I was a kid. You wanted to be like Mike. It was almost like you wanted to be like this hero. It seems to me now people want to be a part of something else. So tell me about Bomba Stocks, be a good commercial, but also like why it's working and the fundamentals of it, so that entrepreneurs listening to this may need to sow some of these seeds in there.
Yeah, I think you hit a fantastic point. So Blake is a guest shark this year, and he definitely is the pioneer of the social causes behind things. And there's so many different things we can learn from Bomba Stocks. So by the way, Bomba Stocks is the number one invested product in Shark Tank history. Really? Number one, right? So I get those bragging rights, because when you ever see those other underachievers, I call my fellow sharks, just remind them that I shared that great information with you. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a couple of things you can look at from Bomba Stocks. Number one, when they came on, they were pitching socks, and the last person they should have been pitching was me, because I had 10 clothing brands and 8 of them were already dead. The last thing I wanted was another clothing brand. Mm. So I was the last one they should be pitching. But often when you're pitching somebody and or a customer, they don't know what you want until you present and package it in the right way and show a unique way of a selling proposition. But what they realized was I was doing business the old way. I was making clothes and hopefully a retailer will buy them, and hopefully the retailer will put it on the shelf, and hopefully somebody will buy it. And if they didn't buy it, I didn't know who they were to even follow up. So they were showing me that, number one, I'm going to show you how to go direct to consumer, which we're seeing during COVID is especially critical, and that's separating a lot of people and companies. Number two, they had a social cause to it. Every time they give a pair of socks away, they would also sell a pair of socks. They would give a pair away to the homeless. Now, I'm a person that grew up in business where traditionally you gave at the end of the year, or you gave to organizations. And even when I gave to organizations, I never advertised it. I never marketed it, because why make a profit off of the hardship of others? Kind of like the people you see giving away food or a sandwich to a homeless person, and they got a camera shoved right in their face going, look at me. Yeah. And they're forcing this person not only to take a sandwich, not forcing them, but to even feel lower because they're on camera, right? Yeah. So I never wanted to do that. However, that was how I worked 20 years ago. Today, with user-generated content and people wanting to get behind something, they want to look through the layers of what you're doing, and they want to tell people, not you, they want to tell people your story. Right. And they feel that they can buy from anybody. So if I'm going to buy from you, what are you doing for other people? I could buy socks from anybody. So what I found is that not only they make a good pair of socks, they're very focused on what it is. But I found that, you know, when people are on Zoom or the dinner table or Thanksgiving, they say, hey, Ed, what do you do? Oh, man, you know, I gave away this year, you know, to this organization. They'd be like, yeah, well, I gave to 30 organizations this year. Wow. You rich? No. But every time I bought this, I helped clean up the ocean. Every time I bought this, I helped stop human trafficking. And every time I bought this, I helped give a pair of socks to the homeless. And you know what? That is the marketing, and that's good marketing. It's cause related. And, you know, it's really important. And so people also can get penalized if they're not doing something for you. And by the way, don't just put a rubber stamp of something that you think is good. If people will also find out if you're not, you know, really true to what your core values are and what you're saying you're doing. So be honest about it, change the world, and people will definitely appreciate it.
That's legit. Any of you that are entrepreneurs who's giving you such remarkable advice, you got to find a way that there's some social viral aspect of what you just got to be genuine. You can't, I think people smell bullshit a mile away, and like, there's got to be transparency. You can't transfer to people that which you're really not feeling and experiencing. It's got to be something you really have a passion for. But if you can find a way to sow those seeds into whatever your business is, I don't care if it's a dry cleaners, if there's something that you do that it extends beyond just cleaning clothes, you're special in this day and age. I'm curious, is there some commonality that we can learn from the ones that you said were the 30% that lost, let's just say? Was there commonality in lack of effort of the entrepreneur, lack of execution? What would you say there's a common thread between the ones that have, I guess, failed?
The commonality in the winners and the commonality in the ones that didn't get where they should be are pretty much similar in some sense. there are many losers who there are many that lose and then they start over more wisely in a different area. So that means that maybe the product and or the service, the thing they had was too soon, too early, or they hit some hiccups. However, just like Damon closing three times, they were able to do it, you know. But the ones who lose and generally lose and stay in that area, unfortunately, are the ones who believe, well, the shark knows everything, and now that I got a shark, my problems are over. And if I knew everything, then FUBU would be called Nike, right? And it's not, right? So they use a shark as a crutch. Those are the ones who say, well, the reason if I had more advertising dollars out there, then I would, or I had more money. And they don't have the orders, they don't have those things, then I would do better. Well, money highlights your weaknesses as well. You know, if you're not moving in a product and, you know, you have a shitty advertising campaign, well, $1 million more in a shitty advertising campaign just means you spent more money on a shitty advertising campaign, or the product is inferior, or you don't know who your direct customer is. Those are the people that tend to fail, the ones who put big bets on the areas they don't know. And those are the ones who drown an opportunity, as you want to call it, or they say, if you have too many options, you don't have enough information.
Really good. You guys know why I wanted him on now? By the way, if you go to Damon's site too, he's got a lot of different programs. Look, here's the deal, you guys. Most really successful entrepreneurs, here's what's a rare combo. That you're a successful entrepreneur, I mean a real one, and you create content. Because the truth is, someone like Damon, and I'd like to think even myself, the return on creating content and helping entrepreneurs financially isn't as good as just executing in the businesses that we have.
Right.
So the reason we do it is out of a sincere desire to serve people. That's what I've sensed from Damon, and now I'm listening, I'm like, I'm so convinced of it. So he's one of the real that you could learn from that creates content. And by the way, is it The Power of Broke? Is that the one I just read? Is that the title?
I have Power Broke. I have Rise and Grind. The one is just out now. It's called Power Shift. I try to put power somewhere in something. You know, I try to fix it, put it in there. Yeah.
I just finished reading The Power of Broke. And by the way, you should get all five books. Guys, it's so good. Like there's books you read and you're like, I'm going to highlight three or four things in here that I'm going to remember. The problem with his book is like there was very few areas I wasn't highlighting. Like the book was highlighted. And one of the things you talk about a lot is negotiation. So when you watch Shark Tank, that's a highlighted negotiation taking place, right? But like almost everything's negotiation.
Yep.
Like that's sales, communication, persuasion is negotiation. What are some of the nuances you could teach us, the fine points of negotiation that most people are unaware of?
There's so many things that, you know, and I think that you're right. What separates us from the people who are successful? It's really what you have negotiated. And like you said, there are so many different forms of negotiation. Listen, trying to get the remote control away from your significant other, or getting your child to get on the school bus, or getting into the bathroom before your roommate is a negotiation, right? But you got to negotiate with yourself first in the mirror in the daytime, you know, when you get up, right? Am I worth it? Can I do this? You know, why, you know? And so here's a couple of things of negotiation. First of all, know your why. Why are you getting into negotiation? And know also in the negotiation, what are you trying to accomplish? What is your bottom line and what is your top line, right? Also, how do you build influence in the negotiation? If you see somebody like an Ed Milet or a Damon John in the elevator, you say, Damon, okay, cool. How would I build influence with you in 90 seconds in the elevator? I didn't know I was going to speak to you. Well, I remember a young woman, I was in the elevator. She told me her business and she had the perfect pitch. It was simple. Here's my business. I know that I can add value to because this is where I think you need. And you know what? I'm willing to put some skin in the game and do this for 30 days, 60 days, a month, whatever the case is. Give me a contact over your company. And you know what? If nothing comes out of it, at least I tried. And you know what? No harm, no foul. She made the barrier of entry extremely easy for me. She had a name on her card, very easy to follow up. And she said, let me speak to your people. I'm not going to even bother you. Mm-hmm. Right. And she knew where I could potentially go in business. I go out of the elevator. I look her up on social media. Every time I see her picture, she looks great. I keep seeing this guy next to her. He keeps having the Confederate flag on. I keep looking at who this guy is. It's her husband. I go further into his page. I see that, you know, there's some things that are very questionable in my life about what I would do. She'll never know why I didn't call her, right? She didn't have to put all that information on there. You know what I mean? I mean, mm-hmm. listen, whatever your political beliefs are, whatever your religious, sexual beliefs are, that's totally up to you. But you know, what our parents tell you, if you ain't got nothing nice to say, don't say it at all. And when you're putting up stuff like that, you don't know who's watching the entire world. She lost her influence after she had already had the negotiation with me. So build influence with people. Then when you go in the room, when you discuss with, don't let Shark Tank fool you. Shark Tank, the world is not like Shark Tank. Like you just said, the world is not 8 minutes of hi, sharks, and then you either leave with a deal or not. You almost never leave with a deal when you first meet somebody. It's a dating process. Sure. And when you are talking to them, what's in it for the person you're talking to? Not you. You got to realize that person has obligations, hopes, and dreams. Ask the right questions. You see, even when I was writing that book, Power Shift, I was Mark Cuban. He's in the book, he's highlighted. A lot of people in the book, right? Billie Jean King, Pitbull, Kris Jenner, huge people. My guy who sits next to me every day on Shark Tank, I keep telling my team, contact him, I want to get this interview together and the deadline is coming up. He would not get on the phone and he would not meet with people, with the writer. And my team was looking at me like, hey, you know, Mark is not doing that. Now I said to myself, obviously it's because I'm much smarter and much better looking than Mark. And, you know, he's intimidated, or I can internalize it as this guy's an asshole. He sits next to me, but is this some Hollywood stuff he's on? Mm-hmm. But you know what I said? You're probably not asking Mark the right question. Mark is somebody who publicly gives out his email. He loves text and whatever the case is. He's not dyslexic. Did you ask him, can he do it over text? They said, we never asked. That's stupid. Mm-hmm. I said, ask him if he could do it over text. Interview was done in 24 hours. Now, I could have internalize that, been offended. It's just like you walk in the room and, you know, and like I said to you earlier, you know, where I came from, I could have walked in the room and somebody said, oh, it's because I'm black, isn't I? No, it's not because you're black. Because you got a damn booger hanging out your nose while I'm looking at you weird, right? You know, so it's all about what's in for the other person. And then the final part of negotiation is, how do you nurture the relationship after that and let it keep paying dividends? Whether you close the deal or not, how is that person going to call Ed and say, Damon's a decent dude, or Damon's gonna call about Ed and say, yeah, he's a good guy, or do more deals after that. And those are the processes of negotiating, and we can get way into it much further, but a lot of people mess up in those processes.
Really, really good. You know, one of the things that happens when you're an entrepreneur is you're so nervous, maybe you're not as confident in what you're gonna say, or you're not as confident in your product or service or what it is. And what happens is now you're so hyper-focused on yourself, you miss the major thing Damon just said, which is that the person that you're speaking to needs to know what's in it for them. And you spend all your time worrying about you and pitching you. That's huge. And then the other thing he said, man, I just got to say this, the social media stuff. Look, people say, hey, if you're not really yourself on social media, you're not being real and legit. Listen, you're not posting butt naked pictures of yourself every, there's a degree to which you reveal yourself. And if you're going to post a bunch of controversial stuff all the time, it's going to impact you to some extent. So just be smart. Like, you don't show all of you all the time, and you shouldn't be doing that on social. So speaking of social, your life's interesting to me because it's like this, you know, there's this first half of your life where you built this unbelievable, I don't know, brand and wealth and that other stuff. But then speaking of your social, so family stuff, I'm just curious with you. There's Yasmin and Destiny, right?
Mm-hmm.
How's that changed you? Like, for me, I was a relatively successful entrepreneur. I had my ups and downs. But once I started, I had Max and Bella, like my, I don't know, maybe my risk tolerance changed a little bit. And also my desire level to make them proud of me, you know, I don't know how to explain it. I became a much deeper committed human than I was prior to having children. Same or what?
Yeah, I think children change your life. So I was fortunate enough to have Yasmin and Destiny when I was early 30s and I just came into money with FUBU. And I had them, my first wife had them. And I was busy at that time. I think like most nervous parents were to say, I finally got this bite at the apple at FUBU. How much money can I make to make sure that these little girls will have the resources they're going to need as they grow older? And I don't care if I work for, you know, the sanitation department. I would have just worked over hour, every extra hour I could have gotten. And as most parents here is, I would sleep in a cardboard box if I had to give my kids the things they needed. My daughter now that I'm fortunate enough to have remarried, and my ex-wife is my best friend, and my two older girls are great citizens and great human beings. So I'm very, very fortunate for that. But now it's, how much love can I give this little girl? You know, it's a little different than before. Even though I love my other daughters, but now it's how much love, because as we all know, as parents, my daughters grew up like that. It just was a blink of an eye. And that's why in Rise and Grind, I wrote Rise and Grind about that, because one of the biggest challenges we'll always have is work-life balance. It's a big question everybody asks. And your work-life balance changes. You know, the Damon John at 22 years old, I didn't have any obligations, right? I didn't have kids. I was able to eat pizza and not have heartburn all night and sleep 3 hours a day, right? So that was a different Damon John. The Damon John at 45 and 50 is the Damon John that learned a couple of lessons of work-life balance. You know, when I was 30 years old, I traveled the world twice and I shook everybody's hand on the planet 4 times. And the whole world was purely a conference room, an airport, a hotel, and a dinner. The Damon John now travels the world and steals a day, you know, to pull my shorts up to my nipples and have a camera and put I Love Grease and walk around, right? Or instead of going to a club, go diving, you know, instead of going to a club, go diving off a different coast, because I've seen every club, but I haven't seen every coast, every coral reef in Thailand or whatever the case is. And prioritize, you know, and when I get up in the morning, I don't look at social media for the first hour. I don't look at emails for the first hour, because the first hour of looking at social media, well, if you look at there, everybody is skinnier and sexier and wealthier than you when they're just as screwed up. And if you open up emails, you're letting, while you're in the bed, you're letting people tell you their problems. They're telling you their problem. I've never gotten an email that said, you know that problem yesterday? I've solved it and there's $5 million on its way. So I don't do that. And I write down what I'm going to do first in my life during the course of the day, because normally our schedule goes, what train or plane or conference call or Zoom am I going to be on and this and that? And then, you know, when we were running around, it was how I'm going to have 2 different dinners with clients that I don't really want to see. You turn around, you don't ever see your wife or your children. And what happened one day was and this is why I called to write Rise and Grind, because I was out with one of my colleagues on a speaking gig. And he said, and he lives in San Diego. He said, I got to get home. I said, why? I got to get home. I got to take my 2 daughters, one is 12, one is 13. I got to take them on separate dates. I said, they're 12 and 13. Why would you have to take your daughters on separate dates? He said, because if I don't take my daughters on dates, how will they ever know how a man is supposed to treat them the first time they go on a date? And it just punched me in my gut. Bang! Opens the door, goes around the car to open the door. You know what I mean? Lets her order first and all the, you know, all the various things. And I said, I have not been putting my personal life, my criteria, the things that are important to me before everybody else. And that's why we're Rise and Grind. So those are the things that have changed in my life as I've grown as a man. And I'm still learning every single day how to be a better husband, a better person, and everything else.
That's what I mean about your humility. That's what I mean. And by the way, guys, in my book, I say, hey, don't check your email and your text and stuff in the first hour. And I have to tell you that I learned that from him. You've been saying that for a long time. And I'm like, that's exactly what I do. I roll over and I start reacting. I'm into my problems immediately. Yeah. And I do exactly that. And the other thing he said too, is like, you know, there are dads, we both know these guys, or moms, but just take dads because we're men, who that date thing comes very natural to them. Of course, I'm going to do that with my daughter. I think high powered achiever, psycho people like us, and many of the people listen to this, that stuff isn't naturally occurring to us. And so, and then, by the way, the guy who that occurs to very easily, he may not be able to achieve and produce like we do. And so it's important to be conscious of those things, because I do that now. I do date nights and stuff with my daughter too, mainly because other people taught me it. Probably my daughter would have left my house, man, after 18 years. It would have never occurred to me that I should have done those kinds of things with my daughter. My dad didn't do it with my sisters. And it's just, I'm blowing and going all the time. So
that's what happened to me with Destiny Yasmeen. I didn't do that with them. I'm going to do it now with mine. She's 4, but I got 13 years or whatever.
I wish I could do it one more time. That would be so cool, have a baby. Now, speaking of that, just life-wise, I got to ask you what this is like. You just found out or recently found out, or you have siblings that you didn't know about? Yes. Am I right about this? Is this actually
You know, so my father left when I was 10, and I never see or speak to him ever again. And I knew that I heard that he had 2 daughters, and I was waiting till they were of age to reach out to them and contact them, because obviously, you know, I knew that he probably, you know, was either ashamed or whatever the case is, or didn't want. And I finally did, you know, and the universe brought itself together, because they found out who I was and I found out who they were. And you know, about 3 years ago, you know, we got together and I've never experienced that type of love in my life. I never had a sibling. So I never understood how it is to have of course, it's more females. I don't have any males in my life, which is a blessing, but there's a certain type of love you have for a daughter, a certain type of love you have for a wife, a certain type of love you have for a mother, but a sister is just a different love. And after 50 years to experience this type of love, you know, it's really enriching and it's a great thing.
Dude, that's so cool. That is a trip. So you knew they existed. You just didn't have them in your life. You had to wait for the right time.
Right, because I think my sister is now 26, but up until 18 or whatever it is, 18 or 21, if I were to reach out to them, I didn't know how this guy would respond, and I didn't want to meet or see my father. I didn't have a problem with the fact, I think, that I wouldn't be here without him, that life has just happened to me at that point. And I wouldn't have taken the role as a man of the house and taken, you know, that side of my family is Trinidadian, and it's part of Indian culture. And I would have more likely have been an engineer or a computer programmer, nothing wrong with that. But I wouldn't have been the entrepreneur that I am today.
What a trip. So a couple things left. I'm enjoying this so much, just so you know. I knew when we talked, I would enjoy it, but like, I'm enjoying it to a degree that.
Yeah, me too.
You know, I would do this, you know what I mean? I would do it if it was just you and me talking. I wouldn't even put this out, but I'm asking you a hard question because it's interesting. You met me at 25 or you at 25 or 30. There's something better about me in some ways at that age than you would get now. There was a scrappiness, an edginess, a fire, something. Yeah. I still have more, and so do you, than 99.9% of the planet has, but there's just something different when you're hungry, right? Yeah. So you know what I mean? It's like how hard a dude will fight to become heavyweight champion of the world compared to a once-or heavyweight champion of the world. Not that either one of us are heavyweight champions, but the principle, you understand the point. So there's a lot to be learned from that 30-year-old me, that 30-year-old you. But there's also a lot to be learned from the more experienced one, too. So here's the hard question, because I've been thinking about this for me, too. What did you used to believe when you were 30 about business or life that you no longer believe to be true? Something that you believe that you no longer believe.
Excellent question. Never been asked that before. And as I reflect on what I believed about life was that the whole theory of I'll sleep when I'm dead, you know, the kind of go, you know, maximize your hours. And it wasn't necessarily working hard and not smart. It was a combination of both. But it was like, how dare you how dare you sleep when you know that you're willing to get up before everybody and go to bed after everybody? Well, then why would you do it? I got to tell you, when I was, I must have been right before FUBU really took off, and I was right in that lull area of not working at Red Lobster, but still working on FUBU, and FUBU wasn't defined yet. And I literally thought I was going crazy for about 6 months because I was actually sleeping like 7 hours or 8 hours a day, and I couldn't go to sleep. I literally thought, now I'm not a person who is suicidal or anything like that, but I got to say it was the closest I got to just being going crazy. So in life, I would think that back then, you know, I did like to take care of my health. I was training, for fitness competitions, but I never competed, but I liked it. But why was I training? I wanted to get girls, I wanted to blow off steam, right? But it wasn't about having health, because then I'd eat a bucket of fried chicken or whatever the case is, and that wasn't a problem. Whatever the case is. So the theory of taking care of yourself internally was not as important then, and it was like, who cares, just go hard as long as you're not going out there and doing bad things. I think in business, my theories then were, acquire, it's wreckable, it's like acquire, go through it, you know, use your tools, build your army, move forward, hurry up, and be in different industries because you never know which one will pop. And then I learned that be more slow and methodical. Don't necessarily rush. You know what? It's more the things that you take on that can hurt you than the things you say no to. Say no more.
Oh my gosh, is that true?
Yeah, it's say no more. Also, it was the numbers look good. I know, but in your gut is telling you something about the person. No, but the numbers look good and I got it. Let's go. No, now it's I don't know if even I have an answer for you, but something about this, I just don't like it. I don't feel everything is great. Sorry, I don't even know if I have the answer. Maybe I'll figure out the answer later.
God, is that not true? The last two things, trust your damn intuition. Gosh, that's so true. There's been so many times like, this just looks too good, but there's something about this dude. He may never be a bad dude. We just don't vibe. It's not going to click, you know? Same exact thing. And saying no. I said no to absolutely nothing for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And it complicated my life. It stressed my life. It took focus away from my life. Man, oh my God, totally agree with you on that. Like a million percent. So you speak about health. I just want to know this because I have had a little bit myself. You had a little bit of almost got this wrong before we went on air, which would have been funny, but you had a thyroid cancer issue, right? So that change anything? Like, did it change your perspective on time or your wellness, your health? Like, tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, and I think I put it in one of the books, but I'd rather tell you it now. It's so listen, at one point, a buddy of mine, a really well-known guy, and you may or may not know, I don't know, his name is Bernie Eumann. He discovered a small act out of Austria named Siegfried and Roy, and brought them to Vegas. And then he also managed this boxer that he met when he was 15 years old named Cassius Clay. He rode him home on his bicycle on the front, on the handlebar of his bicycle, told his dad, he went to the Jewish community, his dad is Jewish, he went to his Jewish house where he lived and said, Dad, and dad was like, hey, who's on your bike? Oh, this guy's gonna be the next heavyweight champ in the world. What's his name? Cassius Clay. So
That's how that happened? I did not know that.
Wow. Yeah. So I was out one day with him and he said, with all the money you got, why don't you take it? Why don't you have an executive physical? And I said, I don't know what an executive physical is. Remember, I never worked in a corporation. I've had a business, and you call it a corporation, yes. I said, what is it? He said, just go have one. So I realized that an executive physical is they put you through, you know, 20 machines over the course of 2 days, and they check everything on you. When usually I was like, I'm okay. The doctor grabs something on me, tells me to cough, and, you know, sticks his finger in my ass and then tells me to go about my way. No problem. And I've been healthy ever since, as far as I was concerned. I go to get this executive physical. They said there's a little bump on your carotid in this area. When they were looking for my carotid, excuse me, they were a little bump here. I go to the doctor. They do a biopsy. They said 90% of chance we're going to be able to tell what it is. 10% chance we can't. Of course, 10% chance they can't. Doctor says, listen, you have a little nodule on your thyroid. We want to, if you were 90, I would say leave it there, but you're 50 years old or 47 or 49. I would say take it out, but here's the chance. 50% chance you're taking out half of a person perfectly good thyroid. 50% chance it could be problematic. I go, take it out. The 1 hour surgery becomes 3.5 hour surgery. They take it out. It's the size of a golf ball. It's a mass. I didn't know I had. I say, and you know, you talk to doctors, they never give you the damn answer. I said, what is it? Is it cancerous? I can't tell you. I don't know. Send it away. You know what it is. Just send it away. All right, send it away. They're going to say, we're going to take 2 weeks for you to find out what it is. In that 2 weeks, the first week, I said to myself, I had to do the why. I had to have the negotiation with myself. I said, you know what? I've lived 10 lives that other people have not lived. I have two beautiful daughters. My mother's still alive. I don't want to see my mother die. And I have three beautiful daughters because I have a super hot wife and a youngest daughter. And if I die, my youngest daughter will never remember me. She's two years old. My wife is so smoking hot. She's going to have another husband in a week. My mother is great. And I don't never want to see me bury my mother. And my other two daughters are great citizens and great human beings. And you know what? Maybe I need to slow down my life anyway. I'm hectic with all these companies and I need to enjoy myself. But I realized at that point, I'm actually being selfish. I'm being very, very selfish. Why should I leave my wife? She finally fell in love with somebody she felt would be around forever. Why should my little girl not see me? What parent should ever bury their child? You know, and why should my daughter not be there and have their father walk them down the aisle? And I turned around and within a couple of days, I said, I'm going to beat this shit no matter what it comes back. Guess what? I am going to be around for my mother to see me. By the way, I do sleep next to a smoking hot woman every night and I better enjoy it, right? I do have a little baby and I'm going to walk my girl down. You know what? And in 1 week, I forgot I was even waiting for results.
Wow.
To come back. You know, I had that negotiation. And when the results came back, I was like, what the? Oh, shit. It's cancerous. Okay, no problem. He comes and checks me though and says, listen, as of right now, you're cancer free. We're going to still keep an eye on this. but I totally forgot that I even had it, right? Wow. And so at that point, I decided I didn't want to go public with it at first because you know how it goes. People hear half a story, and I started getting calls. Damon, I heard about the cancer. You're dead. I just answered the phone, asshole. I'm not dead. But I decided to tell people because what I realized is entrepreneurs, we don't take care of ourselves. We take care of everybody else. And if I can get just somebody to go out there and urge their sister, their brother, their father, themselves to get that endoscopy, pap smear, mammogram, colonoscopy, then I did my job, you know, and that's what I wanted to share with people.
That was one of my favorite stories of all time, the way you laid that out. That was freaking awesome. Something about that, I had a heart issue when I was young, and this doctor did this to get me to take the medication. He did that whole thing with me, like, hey, you got a hot wife. He goes, you okay with some other dude living in your mansion with your hot wife? And by the way, some other dude walks your daughter down the aisle on her wedding day. Ooh. Something about that walk your daughter down the aisle on her wedding day thing is big for a dad.
Absolutely. And
one of the reasons I'm pretty relatively fit is all those mornings on the road when I don't want to get up, Bella's wedding. It's a bigger reason than how tired I am, you know? And so I'm 1,000% with you. I love this. I want to ask you one more. First off, guys, you already do, but make sure you're following Damon. Make sure you're going to his site, getting his books, participating in his programs. Go see him speak when COVID's up. Trust me. It's one of the best you'll ever see. I like when he gets interviewed as much as when he speaks because you can pull so many things out of his big brain. But I want to ask you a question. I've never asked anybody this on the show because no one ever asks me this, but I'm curious. Did becoming successful, and be, you know, I know you'll be honest, becoming successful to the extent that you have, is it what you thought it would be, better, or not all it's cracked up to be?
It depends on what stage of my life I was at. You know, when I was younger and FUBU had started to take its decline, then the ego kicked in of me wanting to go back out there and make sure that people didn't feel I was a one-trick pony and various other things. So I still needed to prove myself to myself as well as to people. And it was a little bit of both. What I thought it would be and what I didn't think it would be, because I still had some levels of insecurity in life. I still had hopes and dreams. So that was something I didn't think would happen. What did I think would happen? Yeah, I could afford to do most of the things that I wanted in life. However, if I tried to keep up with the Joneses, then I wouldn't be able to afford that forever because, you know, like I said, there's always somebody who has more than you, and you know, you need to be comfortable where you're at to make sure that you have everything for the long game. If I had to look back over my life and say, what did I have to do to get to this point? And if somebody would have laid that out to me at 15 or 20 years old, I would say, well, hell no, I don't want to do that. I'd rather just have a regular life. However, when you're in the middle of it and you know, you're too close to it, you know, it's kind of the old saying when you can't see, you can't see the whole elephant if you're only a foot up on the elephant. So, you know, but is it great? Where I am now is extremely, extremely, it is great, great, great where I am now. Because, you know, being the only African-American who has this level of public notoriety that has nothing to do with sports, music, or politics, it's the fact that, as I shared with you, as you know, I didn't have any resources. I didn't have an education. And when people look at me, I think they look at entrepreneurship and say, well, if his dumbass can make it, anybody can make it. And I hope I get that across to people. So whether it's your gender, your color, your creed, your sexual preference, nothing can hold you back. And when you stand on that carpet in front of Ed Milet or whoever the case may be, that carpet doesn't care about anything else besides the work that you're ready to put in. Mm-hmm. And I think that being somebody who can be inspire other people and know that maybe the next Oprah Winfrey or Steve Jobs is 12 years old in their pajamas eating a bunch of Fruit Loops watching Shark Tank or watching me somewhere else, and they're going to go out there and change the world, that is an extremely inspiring place to be in my life.
Brother, I'm so glad you said what you said at the end there. Because I know you get complimented all the time, but I was thinking about, actually, I pray every night, and I knew we were going to do this today. So you just on my mind. So it came up in my prayer last night. I just wanted to tell you this, for what it's worth, from one man to another. I don't know why this makes me emotional, but it's interesting who God chooses in life. And it's interesting how our lives work. I know for me, becoming a successful entrepreneur, there's elements of it that are 1,000 times better. Making dreams come true for family members I never envisioned if a family member got sick. Then there's the other thought. I thought I'd never have any worries or problems, and I thought all my insecurities would go away. Well, none of that crap happens, you know? But there's been blessings. But in your case, you know, and I know you're living it still. You're one of those things where you're too close to the elephant still to understand, but you're one of the most important social and cultural icons in the history of the business world. And the reason is because you are a Black man and you have become in this very prominent role. And if God chose you for a reason, because of your humility, he also chose somebody with this anointed ability to communicate and the breadth of experience. I have a funny feeling that if I met the 30-year-old you, I'd have liked you, but I think I like this version of you a lot more. And you're so important because there are millions and millions and millions of people who just think they're different, whether it's their skin color, their religion, their sexual preference, whatever it might be. And you have been the most prominent person on television for more than a decade that looked different than everybody else did and gave them hope. And the way you articulate it, and thank God he picked somebody who could teach people how to do it at the same time. So I have really huge admiration for you.
Well, I truly definitely appreciate you. I mean, words can't say how, you know, because obviously I respect you as colleagues and stuff like that. And yeah, it's an honor, and I definitely appreciate it. And I just hope that I can set an example for somebody to come out there and be more successful than me and more like, you know, and can spread the message, in a much more powerful way. Hopefully I'm just a stepping stone to somebody else who's going to do it in a bigger and better way. But I'm happy where I am now, and I'm going to keep trying.
Yeah, you're not just inspiring them, you're mentoring them. That's what's cool about social and digital and coming to see people speak. He can mentor you if you just get connected with his work and his content. I loved today, Damon. So thank you so much.
Anytime, brother. I'm really, really happy about it and entertained by it. And I keep learning from you. Thank you for what you're doing, man. And, you know, I appreciate you, man. Stay safe. Where are you at right now?
I'm in La Quinta, Palm Springs, California.
Good place to be, man. Stay safe, man. And happy holidays. Anytime you need me, I'm here. And just let me know.
I'll text you. I do need you, so I will be hitting you up.
No problem.
All right. Hey, everybody. Max out. God bless you. Share the show. Share this with people.
This is the Ed Milet Show.